This is the IBJ podcast for the week of December the 20th, 2021, brought to you by Taft. I'm your host, Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. If we forget about Omicron for a second, the most recent really significant development in the pandemic has been the availability of the Pfizer vaccine, beginning in early November, for kids between the ages of 5 and 11. In Indiana, that happens to be the largest of the age cohorts tracked by the state. There are 608,000 kids in the state in that age range. That's close to 10% of the population. And speaking as the father of a six-year-old who does in-person kindergarten every weekday, I was very excited to see just how quickly Hoosier parents would get their kids vaccinated, and we could ease the ever-present fear of needing to quarantine classrooms for 2 weeks at a time. The response has been somewhat underwhelming. In the last 6 weeks, only 14%, or about 86,000 kids, have received a single shot. Just 8.7% have been fully vaccinated. In retrospect, this shouldn't be a great surprise. If we take a look, for example, at the vaccination rates for kids ages 12 to 15 who have had access to the vaccine for half a year, the vaccination rate is only 37%, and that's significantly lower than the state's average vaccination rate of 54%, which is among the lowest in the country. In the meantime, the highly contagious Omicron variant is reportedly en route to steamrolling through the U.S. next month. And no one is more aware of this than Dr. James Wood, an expert in pediatric infectious diseases and the owner of a very impressive title as an assistant professor of pediatrics at the IU School of Medicine in the Ryan White Center for Pediatric Infectious Diseases and Global Health and Pediatric and Adolescent Clinical Effectiveness Research Divisions. Suffice to say, he is on the front lines caring for kids at Riley Hospital for Children, where dozens are hospitalized for COVID every month. Obviously, we are days away from some of the biggest family gatherings of the year, with plenty of opportunities as well to take our kids to public attractions. I've asked Dr. Wood to give us some guidance for family get-togethers, with a range of scenarios depending on the vaccination status of our kids and/or the adults in the room. What's an acceptable risk, and what is simply too risky? But first, we talk about his experience at Riley during the pandemic, what he's hearing from families that have been slow to get their children immunized, and how many kids have been hospitalized for COVID at Riley over the last 5 months. And we'll kick it off with the overarching question of the season. Is there any reason not to get your kids vaccinated as soon as possible? Here's our conversation. It's my pleasure to welcome back to the podcast, Dr. James Wood. Thank you for making time in your schedule and happy holidays.
Absolutely. Same to you.
I have slightly less than a million questions, so let's just jump into it. And I want to set the stage with maybe the overarching question, at least for me at the moment, when I look at the percentage of kids who have been vaccinated in Indiana to this point. And my question is there any medical reason not to take your child age 5 or older to get vaccinated for COVID at your earliest opportunity?
Great question. I think we're jumping into one of the more important ones, right? And so, there really aren't or very few medical conditions that keep kids from being eligible for the COVID vaccine. We've really seen, a lot of the data coming out from the studies and in real world here, how effective this vaccine is. And really, I know a lot of the conversation has revolved in the past around risks and benefits and all these types of things. And I'm sure we'll get into that. But, the bottom line is we know this vaccine works and it's safe. And yes, kids are not as high risk for getting severe disease, but that doesn't mean they're not in the hospital. And we've seen that. And everyone has fatigue from this. And if we want to get over it, vaccine is our way out, right? Getting people immunized, getting the community as a whole immunized, and kids are a big part of that. So no, there really is not a good reason not to have your kid vaccinated.
Dr. Wood, what reasons or concerns are you hearing from parents for not getting children vaccinated? I know you try to understand these reasons the best you can.
Right. Yeah, no, the biggest reasons that we're hearing for the most part are twofold. One, why would I get my child vaccinated? They're not high risk, right? Kids are not high risk for getting sick or getting it in general. That is one thing that we hear. Another thing that we hear is that it just hasn't been tested enough, or the studies don't, you know, we don't have long-term studies or data for these, for kids in general with this vaccine. And so those are the two big ones that we're hearing.
How do you respond to that?
So the first one, in terms of kids aren't getting sick or kids aren't high risk for getting sick, certainly and thankfully, kids compared to adults are not getting as sick. But again, this is all about what we can do to keep kids safe and keep the community safe, right? And vaccine is it's safe and it's effective. And we just, you know, I try to ask more specifically, like, what are you worried about with the vaccine? Because if it comes down to, I just don't think they need it because they're not high risk, we can dig into that a little bit more and talk about, yeah, that may be true in general, but we are seeing kids hospitalized. We are seeing kids that are coming in and needing to be in our ICUs. And we don't know exactly why, right? Some kids have pre-existing medical conditions. Others are perfectly healthy. And I can't tell you why those perfectly healthy kids got it. There's probably something, you know, very like in their immune system way down that is not allowing them to fight it as well. Or they had a high burden or a high load of the virus, something like that. I don't know for sure. But what I can tell you is that the vaccine is safe. And I feel really good about telling parents that.
If you want to tell parents, well, you know, the proof's in the pudding here. I have two kids. And you have, I think, a 5 and a 7-year-old. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. And then, so what have you done with your kids? Have you vaccinated them?
Yes. We were in line the first day that it was available. And I remember it was exactly 3 weeks before Thanksgiving, because I remember we could get our booster shot the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. And so, yes, we were in line as quickly. We got off the bus after school and went straight to the vaccine site.
You mentioned, I mean, there are kids that that are showing up at hospitals and that you're admitting. I'd ask you for some of that data. I'm going to go through it real quick. We know that in August and September of this year, Riley saw a big upswing in COVID cases, and the number of kids who were admitted for COVID jumped back up to the level of maybe December 2020 mm-hmm. during that surge. Now, in August, there were 48 admissions, 12 of which were admitted to intensive care. That went up in September to 52 admitted to the hospital and then 18 to the ICU. They've declined a little bit since then. In October, it was 39 admitted, 10 to the ICU. In November, it was 37 admitted, 10 to the ICU. So far this month, I think it's 29 and 4. It looks like the trend, if there is one, is that the admissions are declining a little bit. But I mean, from your perspective on the floor there, you know, what should we take away from these numbers?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I think that we definitely saw, and what we suspect and what we think is that, you know, the surge from Delta kind of in that August, September range. And we felt it as well. You know, it was, I remember, you know, going through the hospital and thinking, man, this feels like we are all the way back again, if not worse than we were before. And I remember, you know, seeing those kids in the ICU, and there seemed to be quite, you know, these kids were quite sick. In October, we thought, okay, maybe we're starting to be on the tail end of this, get on the, you know, we might be a little bit of a light at the end of the tunnel here. Unfortunately, I do think we are starting to see it pick back up again. And, you know, you get both these numbers, but we also kind of get a sense from taking calls throughout the state, right? So we are on call for, you know, community hospitals throughout the state, and they call us with questions that they have and things like that. And so the calls started picking back up again, and you started hearing more and more. And so it's just that, again, overall sense of it may be increasing again is what it feels like.
Now, to be admitted, what kind of condition would a child be in if it's that serious?
A lot of that has to do with either pre-existing medical conditions that put them at high risk, or, you know, what they look like, or how they're doing when they come to the emergency room. So if their oxygen saturations are low and they need supplemental oxygen, obviously they're going to come into the hospital. That's probably the most common reason. But even in kids, it's a little bit harder than that, because and this is true of all respiratory infections, there are warning signs that we look for in kids where, oh boy, their oxygen's okay, but they're in a lot of distress, right? So they're breathing very fast. We see them using muscles, like in their ribs, sucking in other muscles that are helping them breathe. those are signs to us they're kind of struggling. And so we'll sometimes admit those kids as well if we feel like they need to be watched closer. So those are the big ones. So that's happening, like I mentioned, both in kids with pre-existing conditions, but also those that don't have any that we know of.
And if you're admitted to the ICU, what usually has happened at that point?
Yeah, those are usually kids that are needing a good deal of oxygen, often either needing very high levels, sometimes needing to be on a ventilator, mechanical breathing machine. Other times, again, it is because of issues with, you know, their pre-existing medical condition and they don't look well. And so we're watching them closely there. So, but by far the most common reason to be admitted to the ICU is just needing a large amount of oxygen.
I hate to ask this, but have you lost any kids?
We have. Yeah. And I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but I know that, you know, we get weekly and actually daily updates, and we have throughout this season have lost more than one.
So the last time we spoke, I think we were still looking wistfully into the future for the development of the vaccines for kids. So this is my memory. In December of last year, the Pfizer vaccine was approved for individuals 16 and over. And I guess Moderna followed soon after.
Correct.
In May, it was approved for adolescents 12 to 15. And in the first week of November, as we said, it was approved for kids age 5 to 11.
Right.
So I'm on the state's website every day looking at all the statistics. There are roughly 600,000 kids in the state between the ages of 5 and 11. And according to the state vaccination statistics from earlier this week, only 8% are fully vaccinated so far. Less than 14 have even received one dose. That's about 81,000 kids. So in the 6 weeks the vaccines for kids 5 to 11 available, less than 16% in Indiana have received a single dose. What is the profession's take on how fast kids are getting vaccinated?
We're hoping to address the addressable things that we can, right? So that's access. Hopefully that's not an issue, but it is an issue in some areas, especially kind of more rural areas. So making sure that we're getting this vaccine to the people that are able to get it and available and easy, right? I think that's one of the things that we have seen. Yes, there is obviously this group of folks, large vocal group of folks that are against the vaccine, but the ones that are for it, they just haven't gotten around to it. Or, you know, because we do hear that too, like, oh, I'm not against it. We just haven't done it yet. Those are the ones I want to be like, let's go. Like, now is the time, right? And so I think that there is part of it as being an access issue, but it's also, again, kind of this, we need to get to the root of why it's not happening. And we're not, and I think that getting good information out to people, and this is why I do a podcast with you. This is why we talk to families. This is why we've done events at the Children's Museum. We're trying to get the good information out to folks, because it is challenging, right? To combat all the misinformation. It's like, vaccine hesitancy is not new. This is novel in terms of COVID, but this has been something that's been going on for a long, long time.
Are some kids coming to hospital who have been vaccinated?
Very few. If they've come in and they've been vaccinated, they may be, testing positive, but very, very few, if any, have come in and needed to be admitted that have been vaccinated. I can tell you just anecdotally from all the ones that I have seen have not been vaccinated.
Oh, and I meant to ask this question in the beginning, but I forgot. Let's say that I know that my child had COVID last year. Does that mean that he or she does not need to be vaccinated?
Good question. And the answer is no, they should still be vaccinated. We know that natural infection obviously does produce an antibody response and an immune response. The vaccine, though, is still recommended, and it likely will produce longer lasting, not, you know, forever, but longer lasting immunity. That infection is almost a natural, you know, it's almost like a natural boost. And so it is still a good idea to get the vaccine.
Yeah. So it's not like chickenpox. I get it once and I'm done.
That's right.
It is entirely possible to get this again, or to get a variant, either one that we know about or one that we don't know about yet.
That's exactly right. Yeah. I wish it was like chickenpox, right? If you got it and we're done and that vaccine lasted as long as the varicella vaccine did, that would be amazing. But we're unfortunately, that's not the nature of coronaviruses in general.
Okay, let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. This is the IBJ podcast.
Taft, today's modern law firm. With more than 625 attorneys across 11 offices, we provide solutions to the business issues facing middle market and emerging companies alike. We do this through a highly collaborative and inclusive team approach. Taft, the modern law firm. To learn more, visit taftlaw.com.
All right, we're back with this week's edition of the IBJ podcast, and we're speaking with Dr. James Wood, a pediatric infectious disease specialist who works at Riley Hospital for Children.
Is there a common piece of misinformation, not just I'm afraid of it, but a piece of misinformation that you hear?
Gosh, probably the one that I hear the most is just about the, you know, mRNA technology being new and understudied, and you know, it's RNA, so it's getting into your genes and it's going to make things bad. And that's a very common misconception, and that's something that people who are against the vaccine will use quite a bit.
We tend to look at mortality a lot, but are we seeing cases of what in adults I guess we call long COVID, where you have persistent long-term health effects? And we're seeing that on the kid side.
Yeah, there certainly are some. It doesn't seem to be quite as common in kids, again, but that likely represents just the, a less amount of kids that are infected compared to adults in general. But we have seen it, and especially in teenagers, and especially kind of our older teens, 16 to 18, they tend to act a bit more like adults when it comes to COVID as well. So yes, long COVID is a concern. It's not a huge number, but there are a number of these. And it is a challenge, right? Because we really, there's not a lot that we know of that's effective in things to do for it, unfortunately.
What do we know about Omicron at this point and how children are susceptible to that?
Yeah, quite a bit of data is coming in at a rapid rate on this right now. So a lot still to be determined, but early kind of studies and data from other places looks like Omicron is likely more easily transmissible, potentially not as severe, or at least not more severe, which is good. A lot is still to be seen with that. But right now it's looking very much like it's more transmissible, unfortunately. So if you look at places, South Africa and others where Omicron has come through, the number of infections has just skyrocketed. And it looks like that it's likely probably a combination of reasons. And specifically with children, I think it's going to mirror other surges where not necessarily more severe, but certainly more infection.
I mean, as a parent of a kid in kindergarten, I mean, that's just chilling. These kids are all over each other, even, when we try to keep them apart. So I guess this is more a comment than a question. I worry about what happens when school starts again in January.
Right. And I think that is, it's a worry that all of us have, right? I think that we're kind of in that, it just feels like we're going back to this all over again, right? Like we were last winter. I do think we're in a better place in terms of having the vaccine available, right? And I do feel really good. There's a lot of concern about, is the vaccine going to cover for this new variant and things like that? And we're still trying to, still looking at the data for this. But all indications look like it is still very good at preventing severe disease, right? And so, again, it's how are we messaging this, right? The vaccine, yes, we do want it to prevent infection, but what we really, vaccine success equals you not having to come to the hospital. That to me is the work, the vaccine did what it was supposed to do. And so I hear sometimes people say another reason, the vaccines don't work. Well, they work really well at keeping you out of the hospital. If we turned this thing into the common cold or the flu, even, it's done its job. And I think that's a success and a remarkable one that I don't think has really been, celebrated enough.
If you don't mind, I want to ask about your kids again real quick and kind of what you think are safe ways to exist in the world. Are they attending an in-person school?
They are. Yep.
And are they masked in school?
They are.
So far, sounds like my experience. Do you guys mask up when you go to public places?
Yeah.
A restaurant, a store?
Yes, we have been. And especially, I felt very strongly about it prior to them being vaccinated. I will say that I was like, oh, maybe we can start to get away from the masks now that you guys are fully vaccinated and the numbers were looking good. And of course, we've seen a cropping back up. And You know, I feel like we've probably talked about this before, but my kids have, I mean, honestly, they don't mind. The mask to them is just like another thing. It's just another article of clothing for them at this point. And so to me, I you know, if it's something I can do to keep them safe and keep people safe around them and they don't mind it, it's really not a big deal for us. And so, yeah, we've been putting masks back on if we go to the grocery store and, you know, they go to piano lessons and they wear their mask during piano, things like that. So it's just one of those things where it's such a simple thing for them to do and they don't care about it too much. And so we just do it.
So for the next couple of weeks, there are going to be a lot of opportunities for families to get together inside of homes and to celebrate. And I want to try to get a sense maybe of some best practices for get-togethers, looking at some possible scenarios. So best possible scenario, everybody in the family has been fully vaccinated and boosted, including the kids. Can everybody be together in the same room for as long as they want without a mask?
Yeah, great question. So those, you know, by far and away, having everybody vaccinated and boosted that's eligible is the best thing we can do. You know, it's safe to do so. And I think that these holiday traditions are really important for everybody. Like we all need these things. It's, again, not a zero risk, but I think most people would say that it's an acceptable risk, right? And so we do things that carry risk every single day. And to me, that is a risk that is worth taking. If everybody is vaccinated, everybody, you know, is boosted, and there are other ways, right, to decrease risks as well. Avoid public places for, you know, a week or two before you're getting into these big holiday gatherings. And if you're going to be out in public, you know, in big gatherings, wearing a mask, stuff like that. So those are, you know, you can do lots of little things like that, that just kind of, when you layer all these things on, make it very much an acceptable risk.
I think one of the things that we were most worried about prior to vaccines was that a child could be infected, but asymptomatic, and then pass the virus to a grandparent. Now, if your child is vaccinated now, are the chances of that child passing that virus to a parent or grandparent, I mean, appreciably lower?
Yes, lower, but not zero, right? Again, like it's definitely lower. We know that, but it can still happen. You know, if grandparent is vaccinated and child is vaccinated, again, and everybody's got to make that decision, right? I think that it's this whole transparent thing of, you have to understand it's not without risk, but for many people, it's worth the risk in that scenario.
This interview could very quickly devolve into 50 shades of risk. but let's take a look at a couple of other examples. So let's say that the adults that are get together are vaccinated, the children are not. Can they be in the same room together? Should the children at least wear masks?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, I would say that the children should wear masks in that scenario. Again, realizing that, you know, kids are going to be on top of each other and doing things that kids do and should do. Most kids tolerate the mask just fine. If they can wear it and do it, I would say absolutely go for it. You know, it's not as much about, it is somewhat about them getting, you know, getting it, but again, they can carry it, pass it to others as well. So yeah, I would say that if possible, wear a mask.
Now, previously, if I remember, I mean, you were okay and I was okay with grandma being vaccinated and the kids not.
Right.
They could still interact and, you know, do normal things.
Right. Again, as long as everybody's kind of above board, we know what's going on. Yeah. I mean, again, especially, you know, what we're seeing is importantly for grandma, for older folks, that booster shot is really important. And so I would feel much better about it if grandma is boosted. Yes. Again, not zero risk, but look, pretty low risk of serious illness there.
Let's say kids at the get together are vaccinated, but some of the adults are not. I mean, that's something I might be headed into.
That's probably a common one for a lot of people, actually.
Should everybody be together for this for this holiday, or at least in the same room? What is this a good idea or not?
That may induce some you know, challenging conversations amongst family members, because, you know, I think for everybody, right there, I know people and I know some folks that say, if even family members, if you're not vaccinated, we're not coming to your party, or you're not coming to our party. That's an unfortunate conversation to have, but I mean, I think it's well within, you know, something that's reasonable. I think it's totally reasonable to have that stance. If you're going to be getting together with folks that are unvaccinated, again, that's, so you're pulling back probably the biggest layer of protection that you can. So what other things can we do to be protected? Mask wearing, if possible, hanging out, you know, I don't, it probably won't be super warm here in Indiana on Christmas, but, you know, spending, you know, not being in a well-ventilated area. And then one of the things that's come up too is testing beforehand, right? So if available and if able, have everybody get tested 24 hours before the gathering. I think that's a very reasonable thing. It's not perfect. At least, you know, the rapid at-home tests are not perfect, but they can give us an idea. And again, it's just this idea of layering protection as much as we can. So if we can, you know, have everybody at least tested beforehand, I think that's it's a reasonable and a reasonable thing to do and a good idea.
Yeah, that's where I've gotten confused a little bit. I mean, I've always preferred the PCR test, but that is not, a lot of times you can't get that in 24 hours. And I've never had a rapid test, but are those easy enough to find? And
they can be found. It's not, it very much depends on where you are. I would say, you know, some of the pharmacies have them, some of them don't, but they are available. You can find them, and you're absolutely right. I mean, PCR is kind of the gold standard and it's the best test we have, but realistically getting them in a timely manner is not always doable. So yeah, the rapid tests are an alternative and a good one in these kind of scenarios.
Now, these questions here are simply for me. We have planned, this is great. I mean, this is, I don't know if you have this feeling, but this is my feeling as a parent. Literally everything that we plan to do, I have to sort of calibrate in my head. Okay, now what does this mean about risk? So here we go. We have planned Saturday to go bowling, you know, at a very nice bowling alley with our six-year-old. He will be completely vaccinated by that point. We're all completely vaccinated and boosted. We feel confident going to a bowling alley.
Yes.
Should we be? And should we just go ahead and wear masks to be good citizens?
I would say that I would, yes, I absolutely, you should be able to go bowling and not be worried about it. I would wear a mask in that scenario, but I would say that, you know, having everybody vaccinated, I would feel good about being able to go. I think wearing a mask, again, just thinking about, is it that big of a deal? I would wear it in that scenario.
Over the holidays, we want to go see my nephew play basketball in a high school tournament. Mm-hmm. So we'd be in like a high school gym. Same group of people. Is that safe?
Yeah, same thing. I think that being vaccinated, I would wear a mask because that's, you know, the gyms are not great ventilated areas with lots of people running around. Yeah, again, I think this is one of those where like these are important things that you do as a family. And if we've made sacrifices, we're going to continue to make some. But in that scenario, I think that for me, that risk would be acceptable.
Okay. I won tickets in a raffle to a Pacer game on December the 23rd. Now that's a big place.
Yeah.
I think we call it Gainbridge Fieldhouse now. That's huge. Should I equate huge with well-ventilated?
Not necessarily. It's better, but it's still not considered a greatly well-ventilated. And especially because when you're looking at the number of people that are typically there as well, but same kind of deal, I think there for me. I went to a Butler basketball game, wore my mask and Hinkle and felt pretty good about it.
Okay, let's say my son, who is fully vaccinated, starts to have flu or cold symptoms. Is that an automatic get tested for COVID?
Yeah, unfortunately, yes. I think that there's really no way to distinguish, you know, a lot of, and we are seeing other respiratory viruses for sure, kind of a big spike in our usual one. So not everything that's a cold or flu-like symptom is COVID, but there's really no way to know unless you get tested. And so, yes, getting tested is the way to go. And my kids have had to experience that themselves.
Yeah. So let's say it's January, school's back in session. My son has been exposed to some kids who have tested positive, but he is not showing any symptoms. Should he, what happens there? Do I take him to get tested anyway?
Yeah, I think a lot of the, schools have different policies, but in general, it's going to likely look like other people that are, you know, other populations that have been fully vaccinated. So if you are fully vaccinated, you've had a close contact. That doesn't mean quarantine because you're fully vaccinated. What that means is you should get tested about 5 to 7 days after that exposure. just to be sure. We usually don't recommend getting tested that next day after exposure because it does take some time if they were to be positive, but 5 to 7 days. And then in that window before you've been tested, wearing a mask when indoors, that kind of stuff, especially in that scenario, right? So you've been exposed. If you're going out into public areas, wear your mask.
But it doesn't necessarily mean quarantine.
Correct.
Until you get your test back.
Right.
Okay. For the kids 12 to 18 who had already been vaccinated, are they going to be asked to get boosters at some point?
Yes. Yep. So I shouldn't say all of them. So right now, 16 and up, you know, the FDA has expanded that authorization down to 16 for the booster. We're still waiting to hear to see what they talk about for the 12 to 16, or, you know, I guess below 16 years of age. We will see what the recommendation is there. But yes, the recommendation for kids 16 and up.
Okay, so we don't have an official recommendation yet for under 16.
Correct.
And what's the time frame for vaccination for kids under 5?
Yeah, that's a good question. The hope was that we would have the data to be, you know, to be ready to go and look at early, you know, January of 2022, I think was the hope that that would be available. And that still may be realistic, but a lot of, you know, that those studies are kind of finishing. Those studies are still enrolling for the most part. And so, you still got to go through that same process that we did for the other one. So I'm still optimistic that it's going to be early in 2022 that we'll at least have the data and see what it says and likely be able to authorize that for the younger kids early on.
And is that a case, like I think it was sort of the case for the 5 to 11s. It's really more about what is an efficacious dose.
Yeah. So they're right. Yep. So these studies are, it is both, it, you know, it's kind of these three, it's a three kind of prong study. It's dose finding, it's safety, and it's efficacy. It's all those three. But yeah, as we talked about, like different from adults where we all gave the same dose, it is the first stages of that is the dose finding where you give the lowest dose and induces the best, you know, it still induces a good antibody response.
Well, this has been fantastic. I feel 100% better about the next 2 weeks. Not the next 2 months, but at least the next 2 weeks. Thank you so much for taking the time. This is always a lot of fun for me and always very educational.
Sure, absolutely.
My thanks again to Dr. James Wood. If you're interested in tracking Indiana's statistics for COVID infections, hospitalizations, and vaccinations on a daily basis, and you don't want to dig through all the numbers provided by the Indiana Department of Health, IBJ posts daily reports that break out the important stuff at IBJ.com. And folks, before you get on with the rest of your week, there are a few stories in the latest issue of IBJ I want to draw to your attention. First up, Duke Energy, the largest electric utility in Indiana, wants to send much of its coal-fired generating fleet into early retirement in 2035 and switch to cleaner sources of energy. But as John Russell reports, some consumer groups, environmentalists, and elected officials contend the progress isn't nearly fast enough. Also in this week's issue, Leslie Bonilla Muniz explains how an unusual public-private collaboration is renovating a 160-unit affordable housing complex on the northeast side and keeping it affordable for the next 3 decades. And Dave Lindquist has a roundup of the holiday season's main attractions as cultural institutions vie for seasonal dollars. Again, you can find these stories in the latest print edition of IBJ or online at IBJ.com. I will say it's quite a bit easier to access all of the latest local news about business and politics and all of IBJ's data on Central Indiana's business community and economy if you're a subscriber. It works out to about $2 per week for actionable information you're not going to find anywhere else. Just go to IBJ.com and click on the subscribe button. And thanks again for making time this week, right before the holiday, for the IBJ podcast, which is edited by Leslie Weidenbender. I'm Mason King. Hope you have a terrific holiday. Hang in there, everybody. We'll talk with you after the holiday.